Voters are increasingly turning to absentee ballots, but they'll have to be meticulous about the paperwork.
There were 23,000 ballots rejected in Wisconsin. Nearly 70% of those were a result of a voter error.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, July 27th, we look at Wisconsin's primary problems and what that could mean for voters in November. Also, concerns about voting access 30 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act.
We've heard stories of people with disabilities who have arrived at polls and been told that poll workers assumed that disabled people couldn't vote.
And how coronavirus is hurting the movie industry.
When AMC theaters said they would be reopening and said that it wasn't necessary for people to show up with masks on, I mean, that's not encouraging me to go back to a theater anytime soon.
But first on the show, today's the deadline for the Trump administration to release detained children on the border to their families.
Let's get started.
Today is the deadline for the federal government to release migrant children who've been held in immigration detention with their parents. That deadline was set due to concerns about coronavirus. The decision marks a turning point in one of the most significant legal cases in U.S. immigration policy, known as the Flores Agreement, a 1993 Supreme Court ruling that required undocumented children to be released to family members after a limited amount of time. Over the weekend, U.S. District Court Judge Dolly G denied a request by the Trump administration to further extend the deadline, but whether the children will be released with their parents is still a question. This is unfolding as immigration detention centers have also been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. So far, there have been about 90 coronavirus infections in family detention centers across the country, and advocates say they're concerned about the growing number of cases. Jacob Soboroff is with me. He's a correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC and author of Separated: Inside an American Tragedy. Jacob, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Tanzina. It's good to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about some of the back and forth that we've been seeing between the Trump administration and lawyers for the family.
Well, I think the most important thing for everybody to understand is that Judge Dolly G called the conditions in ICE family detention, where migrants come and are detained together as families by the U.S. government, as a house on fire because of the rapid expansion of the coronavirus pandemic throughout, not just family detention, but ICE detention generally across the country. Thousands of detainees have been infected with the coronavirus, and around 90 staff and detainees have been infected inside family detention. And so under the terms of the Flores Settlement Agreement, which calls for safe and sanitary conditions for children who are being detained by the United States government, she ordered the release almost a month ago of the children and has already extended the deadline once. As you said, this weekend, she ordered that the deadline will stand for those children to be released. But the big question is not only whether or not those children will be released, but whether or not they will be released with their parents. She doesn't have the authority to order the release of the families together, only the children. And so what lawyers for the children say today is we may be faced with a situation where nobody gets out, and we're at a bit of a stalemate here where the children and the parents remain together inside detention. And the ultimate worry from these lawyers is that these families will be separated, not specifically like we saw two summers ago down on the border, but what they call family separation 2.0.
Let's talk about what that means, because, Jacob, you spoke to Peter Shea, who's one of the lawyers representing migrant children. And that lawyer, Peter, says he's in favor of this sort of binary choice, this family separation 2.0. What does that mean?
Well, we know that the Trump administration has been looking at what's called binary choice at least since August of 2018. New emails that just came out last week from Stephen Miller, as a matter of fact, the Trump aide who is the driving force behind much of these restrictive immigration policies, saw it as a backup plan to family separation after the family separation policy, which systematically, as everyone remembers, separated over 5,000 children from their parents, resulting in what doctors and Physicians for Human Rights call trauma and torture, as a matter of fact, in the words of Physicians for Human Rights, of these children. They were prevented from doing that moving forward. And so binary choice, what it is essentially, is a form that asks parents, would you like to separate from your child in order to have the child released, or would you like to stay indefinitely detained in ICE detention with your child until your immigration case is adjudicated? That's what the Trump administration has always wanted to do. That was the underlying driving force on a policy basis of the family separation policy. And that was told to me by Katie Waldman, now Katie Miller, Stephen Miller's wife, today the spokesperson for Mike Pence, but then the spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security at the time. This is what they've always wanted to do, and now they are closer than they have been to doing it.
Jacob, the Trump administration, as you've mentioned, they have been gunning for the Flores Agreement for quite some time. Can you give us a little background on the Flores Agreement and how it plays into and why this has been such a target for the Trump administration?
Sure. And you mentioned this goes back to the 1990s. I think in fairness, we have to say also the Obama administration wanted to get around the Flores Settlement Agreement in order to detain families indefinitely. They were not successful in doing that. And so while this started in the 1990s, over the case of a young girl, Flores, from here in Southern California, where I am, this is a case that stretched on through the decades. And in 2015, ultimately, Judge Dolly G set this 20-day limit for children who are detained in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, saying they must be released after 20 days. And historically, the Obama administration, after losing that court battle, would release the children with their families together. And immigration lawyers, of course, will tell you they've had individual battles over families being detained. And right now, the families that are detained inside ICE family detention, many of them have been there approaching 1 year. And so the crux of this is where we are now. Both lawyers and the independent monitor and Judge G have all acknowledged that the conditions inside family detention are not suitable for children. The coronavirus, just as it is outside ICE family detention, just as it is in prisons around the country and other congregate settings, is finding a foothold and rapidly expanding. And so that's what we are talking about today. Today, the guideposts of this agreement that were meant to care for the children have almost a special relevance because of how dangerous it is inside. And so that's where we find the urgency that lawyers are going back and forth with not just the federal government, but with Judge G almost on a daily basis at this point.
Jacob, do we know, you know, there's a lot of talk about liability in the era of coronavirus. If one of these parents or their children is infected with the virus and, God forbid, gets sick, then what happens? I mean, who is liable? Do we know?
Well, we've seen staff members in ICE detention at this point die of the coronavirus. In the Eloy Detention Center, which is not a family detention center, a sergeant died of the coronavirus. We've seen many children die of the coronavirus. And the truth of the matter is, I don't know. I don't know what happens if a child dies inside ICE detention of the coronavirus, God forbid. But you better believe that these attorneys, if someone does get sick and someone does die, I mean, that's the warning that they continue to make, is that we are on the verge of someone getting sick and dying now, and that is why they must be released. And look, that's the situation that everybody's trying to avoid.
So this is really a battle that's playing out, it feels like, between the Trump administration and Judge G here. I mean, is there any legal recourse if the Trump administration does not release the children from ICE detention today? What happens then?
I'm glad you asked that. That's a very important question. And the recourse is that they'll have to make the lawyers for the children individualized appeals on behalf of every one of the families. Because right now we're dealing with a class action lawsuit that covers every child that's detained inside ICE family detention. What the lawyers for the children tell me in their immigration proceedings, not the class counsel, which is the attorney that represents Peter Shea, you mentioned him, represents all of the children in the Flores case. They'll have to go one by one and submit specific details about each child and each of their parents as a way to try to get them all out of family detention individually. They had gone in D.C. District Court to Judge Boasberg to try on a class action basis to get the families released, and they were unable to do so. So now they're faced with a situation, if the government today decides not to release the children with their families, and I should be really explicit about this, they have the discretion to do so. They've done so in the past. They could release the children and families together right now, Tanzina, as you and I are talking. But the Trump administration has basically said they're not going to do that. At least they haven't done that to this date. And so it's going to set up a situation where lawyers are going to have to go one by one through each family, lay out the reasons, including asthma, pre-existing conditions, diabetes, whatever the case may be, in order to try to get them out.
And Jacob, there's been some disagreement among various lawyers who are representing migrant children in terms of their approaches to these cases. What can you tell us about that?
So the lawyers for the children in their immigration proceedings have filed what's called a motion to intervene in the case. And that is because the Trump administration has been negotiating over this binary choice issue with Peter Shea, the class counsel who you mentioned earlier. And the lawyers for the children in their immigration proceedings, and I know this gets a little confusing, but just like you can have multiple doctors, you can also have multiple lawyers that look at the same issue. They have filed a motion to intervene saying Peter Shea is not acting in the best interests of the children in these cases by negotiating a binary choice waiver that would ultimately result in either family separation by the choice of the parent or continued indefinite detention in ICE detention where the coronavirus pandemic is running rampant. The lawyers for the children in their immigration proceedings continue to say it doesn't have to be that way. Why do they have to choose between this catch-22 scenario when the government has the power to release the children? So this motion to intervene is basically for the lawyers for the children to get a seat at the table, to say we want to be a part of the negotiation. And Judge G acknowledged she did not grant the motion to intervene. She has not yet. But she said in this order over the weekend that this was never intended to be a way for families to separate without consent of the parent. What the government and the class council have been calling a waiver of their Flores rights is really should be a know your rights document. Here are the rights you have as parents of detained children in ICE family detention. Here is what you can do, and you don't have to do those things. So what the lawyers want is for the government just to release the families together, and they're saying that this negotiation over the waiver process is almost a distraction. It's putting the parents into a box to make a decision that really the government should have to make about releasing the families together.
Jacob, we've seen, particularly over the weekend when it comes to migrant children, there have been some videos and some reports that migrant children are being held at hotels without security or protection from COVID-19. There was one video in particular where a civil rights attorney, from what we understand from a civil rights project, tried to gain access to the children in the hotel and was forcibly not allowed to do so. What can you tell us about these children? Are children being held in hotels, and what's going on with that, Jacob?
They undoubtedly are. And the video you're referring to is from the Texas Civil Rights Project, the legal organization in Texas, obviously. What you're seeing there, and if anybody over the weekend saw that video, under Title 42, this public health law, the Trump administration has been detaining children inside hotels and immediately expelling them back to their home countries. Since family separations, this is what the Trump administration had wanted to do. These are the underlying policy goals that the family separation crisis was meant to effectuate, and now they're doing it without family separation, and activists and lawyers and advocates are not only up in arms, they're concerned for the well-being of the children.
Is there anything, Jacob, in that scenario that can be done? I mean, we saw a civil rights attorney try to gain access to these children and, again, was forcibly prevented from doing so. So, I mean, is the Trump administration just flouting the law at this point by the way it's taking children out of the country?
That's certainly what the ACLU says. You know, the ACLU alleges in this temporary restraining order filed over the weekend that the Trump administration is violating the due process rights of children who are being expelled back to their home countries. So they've asked for a judge to stop this process, to allow them access to the children, to offer them counsel. And that decision has not yet been made by the judge.
Jacob Soboroff is a correspondent for NBC News, MSNBC, and author of Separated: Inside an American Tragedy. And I should just say we reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for comment and have not heard back in time for the broadcast. Jacob, thanks so much.
Thanks, Christina.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. Movie theaters are normally a go-to spot to escape the summer heat. And the summer movie season is when Hollywood does some of its biggest business, releasing blockbuster superhero films and family-friendly content like last year's Lion King remake. But because of health risks during the pandemic, only about a quarter of movie theaters in the United States are currently open. And for the ones that are operating, it's hardly business as usual.
My name is Jonathan McNeil, and I am the manager at the Neon in Dayton, Ohio. We are a twin theater. We have 133 seats in one auditorium and 73 in the other. And right now we have 3 full-time employees and 7 part-time employees. Our capacity is severely reduced, but our need for staffing is greater, so we're paying more to make less at this point.
The Neon had its soft reopening at the end of June and hired more part-time staff members in order to implement some of the public health guidelines, like social distancing. But customers haven't been rushing back just yet.
It has been a slow return for a lot of people. And, you know, Ohio is had been kind of spiking and is spiking right now. But the governor just said that initial numbers are showing promise with the kind of mask mandates that are happening everywhere. So that's encouraging. But, you know, certainly we were going to require masks before it was a mandate. And we have what's called dynamic seating. So our software system actually knows to put 3 seats between you and the next party. And then, of course, every other row is blocked off anyway. So we've got more than 6 feet of distance between you and the next person.
And while the current model of limited seating might not be financially sustainable in the long run, Jonathan says small theaters like his do have one advantage over bigger chains, at least for now.
As far as programming and whatnot for the foreseeable future, it's kind of a mix of some newer indie material and repertory titles. So that's kind of what we know we've got to work with. You know, it's the multiplexes can't sustain 12 and 20 screens of repertory titles, but a theater with only 2 screens is a little easier, in my opinion, to program.
Last week, multiplex theaters were dealt a major blow when Warner Brothers announced they'd be indefinitely delaying the release of director Christopher Nolan's new action film Tenet. That movie had been scheduled to come out in mid-August. And Disney quickly followed suit by pulling the August release of their live-action Mulan remake. And while these delays might not sound surprising in the middle of the pandemic for theater chains like AMC and Regal Cinemas, this was major news. To find out more about where movie theaters go from here, I spoke to Shirley Lee, a staff writer who covers culture for The Atlantic.
Tenet, I think, for most folks in Hollywood, was seen as the holdout. If summer movies were going to happen, if theater going was going to come back, if anything was going to go back to normal, Tenet would have to be released in theaters. But now, like you said, it's been postponed indefinitely, and that is a blow not just to the indoor theater industry, but to Hollywood as a whole. I think for major movie studios, now that Tenet has been delayed indefinitely, there's chatter about tentpole films being delayed all the way until 2021, because over the course of the summer, if you've been following the delays and the changing release dates, studios have kind of been playing this game of chicken, right? Every time Tenet was delayed by 2 weeks, then you saw, you know, Mulan delayed again. So this hopscotching, this game of chicken is now perhaps over, and we have to see what Tenet does next. The latest that we've gotten has just been some chatter from Warner Brothers about, you know, foregoing the traditional global day and date release. So instead of releasing the film at the same time around the world, perhaps they will open where they can, you know, where the coronavirus cases aren't surging.
Let's talk a little bit about some alternatives, right? Because there is the option to do video on demand. Why is that not as attractive as a theater opening?
For films like Tenet, it's simply something that I believe, you know, the director, Christopher Nolan, would rather not do. A film that big, that's, you know, I'm not sure what the exact budget was for it, but it's definitely in the hundreds of millions of dollars. It's meant to be seen on the big screen, seen on IMAX. So for it to move to a smaller screen within people's homes, I think artistically speaking, creatively speaking, it's not the greatest option.
But what about financially?
Financially, it also isn't. You know, when you think about indoor theaters, you're selling tickets individually. Tenet is too big of a film to make all of that money back just on digital rental. And I think for smaller films, it's certainly, you know, more doable. I mean, if you look at the beginning of the pandemic, when Universal released Trolls World Tour, they announced that afterward, I believe the revenue came in at over $100 million. But that's a very different film. That's a family-oriented film. It's a sequel. And I think they were willing to take a chance on that. For a film like Tenet, unfortunately, it is the type of film that folks will argue needs to be seen in indoor theaters, considering, you know, the creative involvement. So at this stage, it's just a matter of seeing what they choose to do.
Well, if we're really going for the theater experience in a pandemic, I mean, the closest I think a lot of folks are coming is to drive-in movie theater experiences. We're seeing some pop up here in New York. You've been to a couple drive-in experiences this summer. What was that like?
I will say the first time I went, I was extremely nervous. You know, I think that even though you're in your own car and you are following all these social distancing guidelines, it feels so strange to be doing something other than going on your essential grocery store run and staying at home. It was strange the first time I went. The second time I went, it felt more normal, but it's still risky because the more normalized an experience outside of your home becomes, the more likely you're going to be complacent about, you know, mask wearing and all of that, right? So that was my experience. I feel like it's probably been different for other folks, but also drive-in theaters can't be the end-all be-all. I think there are only about 300 or so theaters around the country. Even for me, it took about 45 minutes to get to the closest one. So it's not the most optimal experience.
So let's talk a little bit about the financial future of movie theaters and, you know, whether or not the theater business, I'm pretty sure Hollywood will rebound to a certain extent, but what about the theaters themselves, particularly smaller independent theaters?
It is looking dire. I can't predict exactly what's going to happen. You know, I've seen people talk about, oh, what if this is the death of theaters? For now, theaters have been fighting an uphill battle since, you know, the beginning of theaters, really, right? They've gone through world wars, they've gone through the Great Depression, they've gone through economic recessions, but this is certainly the biggest challenge that indoor theaters have had to face, and they haven't exactly been inspiring confidence, especially the larger chains. You know, when AMC theaters said they would be reopening and said that it wasn't necessary for people to show up with masks on, I mean, that's not encouraging me to go back to a theater anytime soon. For the smaller theaters that have stayed open, they've been showing, you know, nostalgic favorites. But it is really hard to stay open during this time. Again, I don't know if we can predict now if theaters are going to be gone forever. I would certainly hope not, because the theatrical experience, I think, you know, personally speaking, I think is irreplaceable. But it doesn't look good. I think, you know, looking at other examples around the globe, China is reopening its theaters, but I believe there's a 2-hour time limit that certainly prevents a movie like Tenet from opening there. You have these innovative designs that some studios or some theaters are thinking of implementing, you know, pods, I think I've seen floating around the internet for a Paris theater. I don't know how feasible those will be, how replicable those can be. But right now, it doesn't look good.
Now, what about the actual, I mean, I sort of said Hollywood would bounce back, but that's not necessarily true. I mean, we know that Hollywood is more than the actors that we see on the screen, and it takes a ton of people to create these films. There are lots of jobs that could be at risk here. So I'm wondering how or whether filming is even happening right now in the middle of this pandemic. We know California is experiencing a second surge of coronavirus. And so I'm wondering what steps are being taken, if any.
Well, there are steps being taken. You know, there have been these white papers, these guidelines released by unions and guilds that have been circulated among the industry. And these are guidelines that talk about, you know, social distancing, about limiting the number of crew members on set, about hiring a coronavirus consultant who can, you know, monitor the health and safety guidelines. And when it comes to productions, they are happening. They're happening abroad. Jurassic World Dominion is filming in the UK, I believe. The sequels to James Cameron's Avatar, they're filming in New Zealand. Now, Within the U.S., I think productions haven't exactly bounced back just yet. The latest that I've been reading have been about productions potentially starting back up in September. There are a few here and there. In Atlanta, Tyler Perry Studios has been, they've been filming some shows, and they have these extensive guidelines that they've been following that involve, you know, flying cast members out using private planes to Atlanta, quarantining them for, I believe, 2 weeks, and then getting tested before they go on set, getting tested once they're on set again. Look, all of it sounds really complicated. The point is there are fewer productions happening right now than normal, definitely, but there are certainly productions that are happening around the world.
And just in, you know, to put this in the context right now, I'm wondering whether or not the pandemic and the racial justice uprising that we've been seeing across the country, you know, we had talked about Oscars So White a couple of years ago. Has any of this resonated with Hollywood producers and executives in terms of addressing better representation in the industry?
I think so. I think since Oscars So White trended as a hashtag several years ago, I think there have been significant changes. If you're looking at the group of, you know, artists that the Academy invited to join them this year, it's much more diverse than in years past. I believe that studios themselves have also been, you know, setting new policies. And there are super, you know, uber producers and showrunners who have also vowed to hire, you know, more inclusive writers' rooms, cast more diverse casts. I don't think that conversation has stopped, you know, and I would hope that just because there's a pandemic going on, people don't, you know, stop thinking about the other issues at play. The coronavirus pandemic is certainly the biggest issue stopping productions from going forward right now, but there is still work happening behind the scenes. There's, you know, writing is happening, animated series are moving forward, people are auditioning remotely, there's work that can be done. And so I would hope that, like I said, people continue to think about representation and racial issues, even while productions, for the most part, are waiting to resume.
And we shall wait and see what happens to the in-person movie experience. For now, I'm making my popcorn at home. Shirley Lee is a staff writer covering culture for The Atlantic. Shirley, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
During the coronavirus pandemic, many people are turning to absentee ballots as a way to protect themselves from the virus while still participating in the voting process. But absentee voting has a much higher rate of error than going to the polls in person. Now, let's be clear, we're not talking about fraud, we're talking about error. In the last presidential election, more than 300,000 absentee ballots were rejected for errors nationally, according to data from the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. And during this coming presidential election, that number is likely to be even higher. The recent primary elections in Wisconsin have shown us that there are still many issues with absentee voting that need to be addressed well before November. An investigation by American Public Media showed that around 23,000 ballots were rejected, and that's roughly the same amount as President Trump's margin of victory in 2016. Tom Scheck is an investigative reporter for APM Reports, and he joins me now. Tom, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey there.
So why did you all choose Wisconsin to investigate in particular?
Well, there were a few reasons. One of the main ones was because it was at the height of the lockdowns that occurred in early April. It was one of the first states that held a primary. There was a lot of confusion and chaos. Some elections officials have called it almost the COVID election. But the other reason is Wisconsin doesn't have a lot of experience when it comes to absentee voting or vote by mail. And when we started to look into the data, we found that there were a large number of rejected ballots, mostly because of what we would consider voter error. A voter didn't sign the absentee ballot envelope when they put the ballot in. A voter didn't have a witness and the witness didn't sign it, or the witness didn't put that person's address down. And any one of those three things gets that ballot tossed out.
These feel like errors that could have happened because people potentially didn't read the form correctly, or maybe they filled it out quickly, or what were some of the reasons that you heard?
Well, the first thing was they were absolutely shocked that we were calling them and telling them their vote didn't count. But when we started to talk to them, they would argue and say, no, I signed the form. I had a witness. That witness was my wife. And yeah, we filled out the address on it. But then when we did an open records request of those ballot envelopes, we found that, you know, in some instances, the spouse signed the form but didn't put the address down for the voter and the spouse. And that would make sense in some instances because the voter would, you know, have the address up above, but that would be an instance where it didn't occur. So they were pretty surprised by it. Some of the voters actually said, you know, I don't trust this system. I'm going to have to go to the polls just to make sure my vote counts. And that leads to some uncertainty about what's going to happen heading forward into November.
Why did people make errors? Again, just sort of, is it just too complicated? Like, I've never voted absentee, so I'm not even sure how the process goes. Do you get the ballot in the mail, and then are the instructions clear enough?
Well, that's part of the thing that a lot of elections experts say, is the ballot should be really clear. It's kind of like when you fill out a mortgage or do a refinance where it says, sign here, initial here. That's what they're saying should be the way that these ballot envelopes are put together. So typically when you get an absentee ballot in the mail, you get the ballot, you get an envelope to put that ballot in, and then you have to put that envelope into a separate envelope. And that's to ensure that when they open up those envelopes, nobody knows how you vote. And then on that separate ballot envelope that you have to then fill out your name and sign it, find a witness, put the address down. And that's all meant to reduce fraud so they know that you're the person who's actually voting. And then from there, what happens is people maybe are rushing through this. They maybe don't find a witness, or they do find a witness. They don't put the address on there. And then what ends up happening is those ballots then get shipped to the elections officer. And the elections officer can look at it and say, oh, this one is rejected. And they can call, in some states, they are required to call the voter and say, hey, come fix this if you want. But in Wisconsin and many other states, there is no requirement for that. And so that's where this kind of gets tripped up. Some elections officials say what should happen is there should be a requirement that every elections official contacts the voter and says, hey, there's a mistake here. And then they have some time in what's called a cure period. Even after the election day, maybe 5 or 7 days after that, they can still come and fix the problem. A lot of states don't do that, though, and that's a big worry.
Are we concerned about how this might play out in other states?
Yeah, every state is different with these requirements. And so in some states, you need a witness. In some states, the elections official looks at your signature on the envelope and then matches it with a signature on file. And that can be a problem for younger voters who maybe don't establish their signature, or for older voters who maybe don't have the same motor skills that they had, you know, 10 or 15 years earlier. So their signature doesn't look the same. Those kinds of things could toss a ballot out. In some instances, I know in Missouri, there's a notary that's required. So you have to have a notary to authorize it. And so these are the types of things that trip voters up. And then if elections officials don't notify the voters, that can be a big problem.
Fraud, the thing that we hear so much about. I mean, I feel like the allegations of fraud and the actual instances of voter fraud are often, there's a chasm in between those two things, right? There are more allegations that this is could potentially happen versus instances of fraud actually happening. So with that said, I mean, do any of the things that we're talking about, getting a notary, having a witness, do they actually prevent the fraud that people are concerned about, or do they create more of an access issue to voting?
Well, we can't really prove a negative to say, well, this prevented fraud. There have been instances where, you know, there's this in North Carolina, in Paterson, New Jersey, where there were ballot harvesting where people took a lot of ballots and then processed those in a way that was nefarious. But in the instances of whether or not this causes fraud or it's a bigger problem, our analysis found that there were 23,000 ballots rejected in Wisconsin. Nearly 70% of those were a result of a voter error. And these are voters who are not, like, they're registered voters. They have the legal right to cast a ballot. And what happened was their ballots got tossed because they didn't sign the form correctly. They missed a witness signature. They didn't have the address on there. So they basically missed a line on a form, which then got their ballot tossed out. And that's one of the things that a lot of voters were really curious about, is they said, wait a second, I'm a legal voter here. I have the right to do this. And yet my ballot was tossed.
Are voters challenging any of these steps that they have to take in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I can tell you, when I was a political reporter in Minnesota in 2008, where there was a very consequential U.S. Senate recount between Senator Norm Coleman and the Democratic challenger Al Franken, one of the things that they found is that the first thing the Democrat attorneys came in to say is, we want to check for any wrongly rejected absentee ballots. And we want to put those into the pot to make sure that those votes count. And then in the end, they ended up doing that and had a consequential factor in that recount where Al Franken ended up winning. And so sometimes you don't see these types of things if the margin of victory is 3 or 4 percentage points, where it's 40, 50, 60,000 vote difference. But if it's a very close election, I mean, you can look at Michigan. There were nearly 11,000 votes different between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton 2016. Wisconsin, Trump won by 23,000 votes. Pennsylvania, Trump won by 44,000 votes. Minnesota, Clinton won by 44,000 votes. And so you have these elections where if there's an increase in by-mail voting, 2 or 3% of that total votes cast are rejected, could start to eat into those numbers in a way that I think voters would be really surprised by.
What can voters start thinking about now so they can make sure that their vote is counted in November?
Well, the first thing is to make sure you're reading the form correctly and filling out everything that needs to be filled out. And then after you send that ballot in some instances, you can go online and check and see whether, I know in Minnesota, you can go online and check and say, okay, my ballot was accepted and it will be counted. That's online. If they don't have that ability to do that, you can call your elections official and say, hey, I just want to make sure I sent in my absentee ballot. Did you receive it? And is it going to be accepted, or is there a problem? The elections officials have to say that. And the other thing is that a lot of the campaigns are going to be watching this too. These are all public records. So if, you know, John Smith has their ballot rejected, and one of the campaigns knows that John Smith is a hardcore Democrat or a hardcore Republican, that party is going to work very hard to make sure John Smith goes in and fixes the ballot. But short of that, those are the only things that you can really do, unless one of the states has a law that says the elections official has to contact the voter.
A lot of things to consider as we head into what I just said was one of the most contentious elections that we're expected to have in this country in November, particularly for those wanting to cast their ballot from afar. Tom Scheck is an investigative reporter for APM Reports. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sunday marked the 30th anniversary of the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, also called the ADA.
And this is indeed an incredible day, especially for the thousands of people across the nation who have given so much of their time, their vision, and their courage to see this act become a reality.
That was President George H.W. Bush at the signing of the ADA, which prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in the United States, and that includes at the ballot box. But while the ADA intended to make polling places more accessible to people with disabilities, they still remain largely inaccessible today. According to the Government Accountability Office, just 40% of U.S. polling places were accessible during the 2016 election. And access to polling locations is just one of several challenges faced by people with disabilities when it comes to voting. For more on this, we turn to Rebecca Coakley, the director of the Disability Justice Initiative at the Progressive Center for American Progress. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me here, Tanzina.
Let's start with a basic definition of disability today. How do we define it?
So according to the ADA, a disability is a mental or physical impairment that impacts an activity of daily living. Our forefathers or our elders or whatever you'd like to call them were very intentional about not including a checklist about what is and isn't disabled. And I think that's very important because if you think about it, back in 1990 when they wrote the law, It was on the heels of AIDS and HIV's massive outbreak in the 1980s. We're also talking about a generation of legislators and advocates that came out of the Vietnam era, people with both physical and mental trauma as a result of their time in military service. So disability was not just white dudes in wheelchairs, even though that's what we see on our parking signs. Disability was mental health. Disability was chronic, was and is chronic illness, you know. And if you think about it today, if they hadn't have been that flexible in terms of the actual definition of disability, it wouldn't include kids in Flint who are drinking leaded water after all this time. It wouldn't include students in Compton, California, who sued to be able to receive special education services, citing that poverty, in effect, had made them disabled. And it wouldn't include people today who are living with the long-term impact of the coronavirus.
Let's talk a little bit about where we are in terms of access to voting. We are in a contentious election season, probably one of the most significant elections that many of us have witnessed in our lifetime will be happening in November. So tell us, before the ADA, what did voting rights and access look like for people with disabilities?
It was very much a hodgepodge. I mean, I remember going to vote with my father, who was a wheelchair user, when I was a small child, and I remember us having to sit in our car and wait for someone. I had to run in, actually, to the polling place, which was at a church. And let's remember that churches are actually exempted from the ADA, which is really problematic when it comes to voting, because churches are one of the most popular voting sites. So I remember running into this church and asking them to bring out a ballot to my dad, who was sitting in his van, because there was no curb cut for him to bring his wheelchair up. There were three steps outside of the church. There was no ramp down to where people were actually voting inside the church. And so, quite literally, a poll worker just came out and handed my dad his ballot and, like, sat there while my dad voted. And that's actually a very common story for a lot of people with disabilities. Or, you know, it was a, we've heard stories of people with disabilities who've arrived at polls and been told that they, meaning the poll workers, assumed that disabled people couldn't vote.
Rebecca, tell us about what are called incompetency laws and how those affect the right to vote for some people with disabilities.
So incompetency laws vary across the nation, and there are laws that are put in place. They're also typically called guardianship laws. And these are laws that are specifically target largely people with mental illness, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and are typically put into place as somebody transitions from special education to whatever comes next. Parents are largely encouraged to apply for guardianship for their loved one under the premise that should they not, they'll have no say in any of the decision making as it relates to that person, their education, or their care. However, this is simply not the case. But one of the things that we have seen as a result of this is tens of thousands of disenfranchised voters around the country, depending on what a state's given definition is. I think probably one of the best cited by the disability community, but least known by mainstream society, is Britney Spears. Britney Spears is not able to vote in this current election.
And she's not able to vote because
Britney's father and her business manager have her under a guardianship plan. And so because Britney is under guardianship, she is not able to cast a vote in this election.
Rebecca, how have these incompetency laws been justified?
They've really been justified because our nation still largely operates off of a framework of paternalism when it comes to people with disabilities. The ADA is 30 years old, and while it is middle age, you can say in some ways it is sort of having a midlife crisis at the moment. But what we've seen as it relates to the guardianship statutes is that people really apply for these for their loved ones out of thinking, well, if I don't do this, who's going to have a say in the person that I love's health care? Who's going to have a say in their financial obligations? Or, you know, what if they are the target of fraudsters? And so I think there's a real opportunity here to broaden the conversation and, you know, share with folks that are listening that this isn't the only option. I think it's also important to note that the number one reason that people with disabilities challenge their status, they challenge their quote unquote guardians in court, is to vote. We hear that time and time again from people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and people with mental illness who want to be able to vote, but find that they're not eligible to vote under their state statute.
How has coronavirus affected access for people with disabilities so far?
Well, we know that roughly one-third of the individuals that have died of coronavirus are people in nursing home settings. And while society likes to put out the notion that it's only seniors in nursing homes, the reality is that there's a large number of people with disabilities, including children with disabilities, in nursing homes around this country. Also, people with underlying conditions count as people with disabilities under the ADA. We know that these folks often are also individuals of color. So we're also talking about issues of systemic racism in the medical field when it comes to this. And so when we're seeing who's dying, it's largely people of color with disabilities.
Like I mentioned, we have a very important election coming up. What should we expect at the polls come November for compliance with disability regulations so that people with disabilities can actually exercise their right to vote?
Well, frankly, I'm not holding my breath. One of the biggest challenges with the data that we continue to see out of the GAO is that that number, that 60% of polling places are still inaccessible in one way, shape, or form, has held steady over the last three presidential cycles. I think given the circumstances of the coronavirus, the best case scenario is a mix of universal vote by mail, so everyone would receive a ballot, as well as limited in-person options. Because let's be real, even vote by mail is not accessible for all people. And so we still need in-person options. And so I think the best case scenario is a blending of early voting and making National Voting Day a holiday. But that must be done with early voting, or we'll actually see a disproportionate impact on disabled, senior, and low-income voters.
Rebecca Coakley is the director of the Disability Justice Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have you or someone you know been affected by the Americans with Disabilities Act? What has it meant for you and your life? Leave us a message at 877-869-8253. And that's all for us today. It's always great to have you with us. You can give us a call about any story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Go get some rest. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll talk to you then.